Hi, folks. This is usually where you hear a computerized voice tell you that you're listening to a free podcast of the Majority Report, which is live every day from 11:30 to 1. Generally, the free portion of the show is 40 minutes long, and the additional better half of the show goes for another 50 minutes every day, which you can access if you are a member. Today, however, on the better half of the show, where we usually have interviews and other news stories, today we had an interview that I felt we cannot keep behind a paywall because it deserves to get out there. We spoke to one of the first people to be arrested in the Occupy Oakland arrest that took place just the other night. She is a 42-year-old woman with MS. Her story and her account is really important and inspirational, and so we're going to make the whole show free today. In addition, we had one of our regular callers call in from Phnom Penh. He has just escaped the Thailand floods. This is also a story that, you know, if you listen to the members show, the better half every day, you've been aware of. I wanted to make these available to you, even if you're not a paid member. Again, as always, I ask that you become a member to support the show, not just to get the better half of the program, but also to support the show. You can also vote for us at podcastawards.com. We have one more day of voting for that. So enjoy this entire freebie Wednesday. Okay, here's the show.
You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me. And I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, October 26, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District. Today on the program, Doug Henwood of Left Business Observer, author of the book Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom. Also on the program, Occupy Oakland, more violence, cops lobbing all sorts of sound grenades, tear gas. Mitt Romney, massive flip-flop in Ohio, always fun to watch. The Republicans manipulate President Obama's strategy on the jobs bill. Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
New student loan policy by Obama, implemented by executive order. We'll talk about that. And more news from Occupy Wall Street. Of course, as the movement continues to press last night in downtown New York, the community board, of which Zuccotti Park, formerly Zuccotti Park, now Liberty Square, is located, voted overwhelmingly to continue to support the occupation. The big issue, drums. Drums were the big issue. We reported, I think it was yesterday, that the General Assembly had come to a deal with the drummers to drum for 4 hours. Apparently, the deal that was struck with the community board was to drum for 2 hours And so, you know, there'll be a little window of a couple hours where people will be annoyed by the drums, but I think they'll get over it. The big issue is whether or not the community board was going to continue to support the occupation. It has. You know, sometimes you promise, sometimes you ask for 2 hours, you get 4 hours. That's the only way. That's the way I negotiate, frankly, with my daughter. I say, you got to go to bed in 5 minutes. She says, how about 10 minutes? I say 2 minutes. She says 6 minutes. And then fortunately, she can't tell time anyways. So that's the way we resolve that. I'm not as anti-drum as some, and we talked about that yesterday. In the better half of the program, today in the better half of the program, we'll get a call from someone who was arrested last night in, or I should say, basically Tuesday morning, she was arrested. She was released. She's going to talk to us about what happened and what they told her, where she can go now without being arrested. Et cetera, et cetera. More violence. We played sound yesterday of Occupy Oakland protesters approaching cops to try and get to City Hall. Many of those people were stopped. And then as the day went on, protesters gathered again. And listen to some of this sound. It is unbelievable. It sounds like a war zone. And in fact, in many respects, you know, the cops were lobbing tear gas. They were lobbing sound bombs. They were reportedly shooting rubber bullets. They claim they weren't, but there's plenty of evidence that they were. Pictures of people getting welts on their bodies. And one guy with actually showing rubber bullets. This is
the thing is, Oakland PD claims that they weren't the ones shooting rubber bullets, but they're not accounting for the outside county police, the police in the surrounding areas.
There you go. It's a complete mess in Oakland. Apparently, the Oakland PD commissioner had quit about a month ago. Is that right?
Yeah, he complained. He complained that he wasn't actually in power in making the decisions, but he was getting all the blame for things when it went wrong.
And this was before Occupy Oakland. So there's obviously some weirdness going on in the upper echelons of I don't know if it's on a county level, if it's on a city level. Something's weird going on there. But just listen to some of this. This is number four. So there you have it. Just some sound clips. We'll play more clips as the show progresses. But now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Doug Henwood. He is the editor of Left Business Observer and also the author of Wall Street: How It Works and For Whom It Works. Available free now at wallstreetthebook.org. Let me ask him just to confirm that's the website. We'll be right back. She starts breaking down, stop breaking down. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Doug Henwood. He is the editor of the Left Business Observer and also the author of Wall Street: How It Works and For Whom, available for free now on, what is the website, Wall Street the Book?
Yes, wallstreetthebook.com. No relation to Oliver Stone's movie.
I understand. Well, I guess that cuts both ways.
Yes, it does.
So, all right, Doug, there's just a ton of stuff I want to talk to you about, but let's just start with Wall Street and who it works for and for whom. I mean, I know you share the belief that essentially the Wall Street class, as it were, that finance has largely become has gone beyond its useful social function. Tell us what it's supposed to do and what it has sort of mutated into.
Well, you know, in theory and what you read in textbooks and what, you know, publicists for the New York Stock Exchange will tell you is that it's all about raising money for industry. That is to, you know, savers with spare cash can, through the mechanisms of the financial markets, stocks and bonds in particular, could provide money for companies that needed to invest and to expand, to hire, to develop new products, whatever. In fact, it does very, very little of that. There's the venture capital industry, which I'm hearing some kind of noise. Are you hearing that?
I'm not.
Okay. All right. Then
bear with me. I'm sorry. I'll check and see what that is, but I don't know what that.
Now it's passed.
Okay.
All right. So there is a venture capital industry which does provide important funding for startups, but that's actually rather small and dwarfed by the day-to-day trading activity of existing securities. So what does it do? I mean, it really doesn't. Most corporate investment is financed internally. That is, companies finance their investments through their profits and cash flow. They don't really need to go outside very much. And when they do go outside for finance, they typically go to banks and not to the financial markets. So what is all this activity, this furious activity, all this all about? I would say that it's really about staking a claim on other people's labor through dividends and interest payments. And really controlling, owning and controlling the productive apparatus of the economy. It's a small group of people, a very small group of people, rich individuals and their hired hands, money managers, really own and run the productive apparatus of the U.S. economy. And you can say similar things about other economies abroad. And they don't really contribute much. They're not contributing finance, and they certainly don't have much expertise about the businesses of the companies that they own and dictate policy to. They're just there to line their pockets, and they do a very, very effective job of it. I was just looking at the Congressional Budget Office numbers on income distribution that came out yesterday. They're stunning. You know, the richest 1% has gained 275% in after-tax income over the last 30 years. The rest of the population has gained about 40%, which works out to less than 1% a year in gain. The top 1% used to claim as much as the bottom 20% about 30 years ago. It now has as much as the bottom 40% of the population. So when the Occupy Wall Street people say it's 1% versus the 99%, they've got it exactly right. It's not just a slogan. It really is true.
Well, there's a lot of things that have accounted for this growth in income disparity over the past 30 years, and I think to a certain extent it can be tracked back to the Powell memo, the famous Lewis Powell memo back in the early 70s, to the group that assembled in Sharon, Connecticut, at Buckley's house. This sort of
the Sharon statement. Yes.
Exactly. Tell me the what you see as the actual sort of primary factors that have driven this. Because I mean, I think there seems to be so many different aspects of this, but it's clearly the financialization of our economy in many respects. I mean, you talk about it in the context of Wall Street becoming less about providing capital and distributing risk for companies. It also seems to me that the way that that compensation changed for CEOs and board of directors when it became much more of a they almost developed their own sort of financial cottage industries on the side. Their corporations became ways of enriching themselves through their stock options. What other elements contributed to this?
Yeah, well, you know, the story I would tell is that in the 1960s and 1970s, the labor markets were tight. Workers had high expectations and pressed for higher wages. But also in the 70s, a lot of the spirit of rebellion of the 60s that was confined mostly to the student population spread into the broad working class. And there was a lot of concern, not just about pay, but the meaning of work. There's just like people thought their jobs were repetitive and alienating and soul deadening. And it really spread into a class of society that hadn't felt that way before. The elites became very, very alarmed by this, and the sense of rebelliousness and expectation and demand. They talked about inflation, and certainly inflation was very bad in the 70s, but part of what they meant by inflation was just this, the sense of a loss of control, that the normal hierarchies of society were being overturned. And the Powell memo you mentioned was part of the kind of coming to consciousness by the upper classes. A real class consciousness developed in the upper reaches. This was in large part the result of a bunch of policy intellectuals, and actually not the business class itself. Sidney Blumenthal has a very interesting book called The Rise of the Counter-Establishment about how that all that happened. It was, you know, think tank, right-wing think tank guys and intellectuals who got very concerned that things were getting out of hand and we needed a crackdown. So by the end of the 70s, there was tremendous pressure. You know, Citibank chair Walter Wriston said, we didn't like Reagan at first, but then we came to like him. They didn't trust him at first because he seemed like, you know, just this actor out of California, but then they were very charmed by him. You know, and Reagan, certainly no intellectual, but, you know, I think a lot of people don't take him seriously enough. I mean, he was a very important political figure. He really was able to galvanize a political movement to rework the whole structure of American society and, by extension, the whole world. I mean, he had an influence around the world, Thatcher to a lesser extent, but Reagan really, you know, had a very profound effect on the whole world. So we saw late in the 70s, 1979, Jimmy Carter was urged to appoint Paul Volcker as chairman of the Federal Reserve. Carter had no idea who he was, but David Rockefeller recommended him, and Carter appointed him. His political advisor, Burt Lance, says, if you do that, you're not going to get reelected, and Lance turned out to be correct. But Volcker took office and promptly created the deepest recession since the 1930s. Unemployment went over 10%, and it just scared the daylights out of the American working class. And all that sense of rebelliousness of the 70s was completely shattered by that recession. And then Reagan came into office and fired the air traffic controllers. It became open season on unions. You know, then we saw social spending cuts. A really very successful class war from above that raised corporate profits. And at the same time, in the financial markets, shareholders who had been very passive since the 30s then started asserting themselves, and they started demanding more profits out of the companies, more productivity, more profits. That meant wage cutting. It meant union busting. It meant taking away benefits. All, you know, this sort of war on workers that had become very familiar over the last 30 years. There's the political side coming from Volcker and Reagan, but also the side coming from Wall Street, where the shareholders just demanded more, more, more. And one way they got that, turned that into reality, was to change the way that CEOs were paid. So they wanted CEOs to think like shareholders. So they don't get paid so much in direct salary, pay them with stock. And they will be very motivated to do everything to get the stock price up. So you know that cottage industry you talk about, compensation, where all these guys sit in each other's boards and approve each other's pay packages, you know, backdated stock options and all this stuff that goes on. But you know, we went from certainly hardly an equal society in the 50s and 60s. You know, there's certainly a lot of inequality then. But CEOs and bankers just your average Wall Street guy did okay. They did fine, but you know, they didn't rake it in the way they do now. I mean, the kind of plutocracy that's developed over the last 30 years is just remarkable, and I'd say decadent.
I'm reminded. There's two things that come to mind. Is one is there's a quote by Alan Greenspan who, when he came in, he perceived his job, at least in part, to maintain some anxiety amongst the workforce. Certainly over the last 10 years, corporate profits and productivity have gone up. Wages have remained stagnant and actually dropped. And that's a function of that effect of the corporate leaders essentially running their businesses to increase stock value, making semi-short-term decisions that would raise that value and not really dealing with the long-term health of a corporation or the long-term health of society, of the people who are supposed to buy their products.
No, that's absolutely true. You know, corporations now have been very profitable, despite the fact that the economy stinks. There was a brief dip in profits in 2009, but they recovered very dramatically. Wages have gone nowhere. Even not just individual wages, but you know, just wages throughout the entire economy. The labor share of national income is down, and profits are up. It's just been and despite what. This is officially an economic recovery. It doesn't feel that way to most people. It feels like the recession never ended. But you know, by the official measures, the recession is over, and corporate profits have been zooming ever since. It's the corporations have just tons of money on their balance sheets. They're not spending it. They're not hiring. They're not investing. They're not expanding. They are doing some of that abroad, but they still have all kinds of money here that they're just not spending. Yet, you know, they talk about they want tax cuts, they want tax holidays, you know, and all Republican candidates are talking about how the upper classes need more tax cuts. It's just, it's remarkable. But it's finally exciting to see some kind of popular rebellion against this developing.
Absolutely. Now, I want to ask you about let's just, I want to talk briefly just about that sort of central assumption in the way that we do measure whether we're in a recession and those central assumptions that go into measuring the success of an economy. You know, our GDP, we're not experiencing 2 quarters of negative growth, so we're technically not in a recession. But we have this incredible amount of unemployment. We have an incredible amount of anxiety felt by now polls are showing, you know, the majority of people. Isn't that almost sort of the original sin in some way, that we decide to measure the success or the of our economy based on numbers that don't necessarily reflect how the broad measure of people are doing?
Yeah, I mean, the official arbiter of recessions, the National Bureau of Economic Research, there's a group of economists that meet and declare these things, recession on, recession off. And they do it with a bit of a delay, but you know, their standard measures are GDP and employment. You know, the job we stopped losing jobs in 2009, but we've added very, very few. At the present rate of job growth, it would take something like 30 years to replace the jobs that we lost in the recession. So you know, we're in a deep hole in the job market, which is what matters for most people. But we do have this system where people exist to serve the productive structure. You know, it's all about people serving the GDP and not GDP serving people. So, you know, if the GDP is rising, we're doing okay. Now, I think we do see some worry in elite circles. The Fed governor, Daniel Torello, gave a speech the other day about how the labor market is basically in crisis. I mean, you know, so we have people in the Fed who are not normally concerned about the state of the job market, who are very concerned about what this means. Because I think they're, you know, these people... quite a few of them, not all of them, but quite a few of them are very sophisticated elite thinkers. Those sorts of things are in scarce supply. I think part of the problem with this country is that our elite has become totally corrupt and short-sighted and just wants to stuff its pockets as much and as quickly as possible. But, you know, some of these Fed guys are actually concerned about the long-term stability of the system. They have to worry that, there will be some sort of disorder. Even New York Mayor Bloomberg said a couple of weeks ago, just before Occupy Wall Street started, as a matter of fact, he said, if we don't do something about unemployment in this country, we're going to see riots. So I think, you know, there is some anxiety at the upper reaches, at least the more sophisticated parts, neighborhoods of the upper reaches. But, so far policy is not doing anything about it.
Do we have the leverage with the elite, and by we I mean essentially, for lack of a better term, the 99% of us, do we have the leverage that we used to have? I mean, that's one of the great concerns that I've had over the past year as I talk to people, that the relationship between the plutocracy or the plutocrats and the rest of us has changed because of globalization, because we have a system that allows for so much offshoring. Do we have the same leverage? I mean, do these people at the end of the day really care? I mean, do they have enough skin in the game of American society that if there is this level of disruption that it can actually change their behavior?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know the answer to it. You know, most of them still live here. They haven't moved to China. They haven't moved to India, and they're not likely to. So there's only so there are limits to the degree to which they can insulate themselves. But you know, we look at Haiti, for example. If we're heading in that direction, you have elites that live not merely in gated communities, but you know, behind fences with machine guns guarding them. I mean, I suppose we could reach that sort of level of insulation by the elite, but we're not there yet. And we just there is still the power to strike. There's you know, still the power to disrupt. You know, all those things do work. And I've noticed that because of Occupy Wall Street, just regular non-political people have actually been talking and thinking about these issues in ways that they weren't 2 months ago.
Yeah.
I don't really know where this is all going, but there does seem to be something seems to be shifting. And I think, you know, as I was saying, the more enlightened portions of the elite are nervous about it. On the other hand, the less enlightened portions of the elite are not. And I guess they figure they can just insulate themselves more and more if they
Let me ask you about that, because, you know, I spoke to Ari Berman yesterday, who has a piece, I think it's in The Nation, about the austerity class. And one thing that has always that has been befuddling me is there are two different types of people who are sort of espousing austerity, less so, frankly, in the past month. Or at least they're having less access to the narrative. But you have the right wingers who are espousing austerity, and I can understand the rationale behind it from their perspective, because it's really simply a way in which they can attack government and undermine government's relationship with people. But when I look at like the Rubenite set of people who are pushing austerity, what I don't understand is what is the rational basis for their even if it's self-serving, what is the rational basis for their sense that we need to and maybe we can include President Obama in this group as well, their belief that when families are tightening their belts, government has to too. There seems to be no empirical basis for that, at least in terms of the health of an economy. Is there a rational basis that they at least perceive?
Well, they're worried about bonds. You know, they're worried about the U.S. Treasury. Well, we lost a notch in our rating from Standard & Poor's, but you know, they're worried about maintaining the U.S. Treasury's sterling reputation in the credit markets. Part of the issue is we've had very large deficits in recent years. It's the stimulus package and the financial bailouts and the recession. If the economy recovers, presumably may someday, one hopes, then you know, there's no reason to get alarmed about the size of deficits. They like to use this moment of deep deficits to push cuts that would not be possible politically in more normal times. I think we need. Our healthcare system is insane. Most of the long-term problem with our budget is rising health costs.
Right.
Part of that is the aging of the population and the baby boomers retiring and starting to go on Medicare. But a lot of that is just pure medical inflation. We have an insane system of healthcare finance. We could cover the entire population far more cheaply with you know something like a single-payer system. But that's just not. You know, polite people don't say that.
We're extremely impolite here. I mean, the idea that, you know, we not only could we save 25%, 25 cents a dollar on the administrative costs of the insurance, we could also have a more rational, we could impose more rationality on the way that healthcare is delivered. But I want to go back to this because, you know, I'm looking at the bond markets here, and whether it's 10, 20, or 30-year bonds, they're at the lowest interest rates that they have been in years and years and years. The idea that somehow hyperinflation is going to come out of nowhere, is this what really drives someone like, a Rubin type who is worried that we're not going to be able to borrow money? I just don't understand it.
No, it's the Yahoos are ones who are worried about hyperinflation. I mean, I think it's almost a sure sign you're a Yahoo if you're worried about that. But, you know, Rubin is not a Yahoo. Rubin's a smart fellow. But their baseline assumption is you cannot raise taxes on rich people because they are the rich people. And so something has to give. Now, if you look at the Congressional Budget Office projections, for example, about Medicare costs in the future, they keep rising because of this insane system of healthcare finance we have. But I've played with these numbers myself. If you could, we would have no budget problem at all if we had a single-payer healthcare system,
right.
Cut back the Pentagon to a reasonable level, and raise taxes in the top 5% of the population. We could have very reasonably generous welfare state, universal coverage on health insurance, and a perfectly balanced budget over the long term if we did those things. But we can't cut the Pentagon, we can't raise taxes on rich people, and we can't have a single payer system. So therefore, the only alternative in the eyes of people like Rubin is Medicare cuts. And Obama, when he came into office in March 2009, his people told David Brooks of the New York Times that they were very serious about going after entitlements.
He was on record as early as January of that year talking about a grand bargain. But this continues to be the thing that's befuddling me here, is that you ostensibly, I understand the idea of why Paul Ryan is crying about the deficit, because it gives him an opportunity to cut things like Social Security and Medicare. In Social Security's case, it's been a 80-year project by the right wing to get rid of Social Security. But when you're talking about someone like the so-called centrist, and we know that in a time of recession, the government is the only vehicle into which to jumpstart the economy, that at this point we should have more of a deficit, frankly, if we want to jumpstart the economy. Yet we still hear this notion of austerity. We still have this irrational, it seems to me, fear that we're not going to be able to fund our borrowing because bonds won't be attractive. Is it simply the fact that they're just worried about the slightest bit of inflation devaluing their bonds?
I think they're also worried about class power. I mean, I guess that's why we started this interview by talking about how Wall Street is an instrument of power, elite power, and they don't want anything that's going to disturb that. So if you start talking about taxing the rich and creating a single-payer system, that changes the balance of forces between the 1% and the 99%, and they don't want that. They want to draw the line. And when they think of, as I said earlier, when they talk about inflation, they're not just talking about rising prices. They're talking about a sense of losing control, that the society is not they're not in the driver's seat anymore, and they don't like that. Somebody like Rubin is sophisticated enough to know that, this is not the time to balance the budget right now, like the day after tomorrow, as the Republicans would like. But over the long term, people like him are concerned about stability and maintaining the present unequal distribution of income. That the top 1% has raked it in over the last 30 years, and they want to keep things that way. They like it. And so the centrists in the Democratic Party are basically a Wall Street mouthpiece. They aren't as insane as the Republicans, who are obviously completely insane. But we have a choice between the status quo and utter insanity. That's the range of acceptable discourse.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Occupy Wall Street for a minute, if you don't mind. I've seen you on some panels. At least one that was on video, talking about sort of the methodologies and where this might go, and where do you think it has to go in terms of obviously it has to get bigger, but I'm less concerned about demands and more about sort of long-term strategy and tactics. What do you think would be more most effective in terms of those long-term strategies and tactics?
Well, that's where I don't really know. I mean, it's been very successful at focusing attention and changing conversation. It's just been remarkable what's happened in the last month, the way it's really just transformed. I dropped in on Zuccotti Park when they were first there, and it was just a pretty small gathering of people.
Right.
And I was there just yesterday morning, and it was just – it's packed. It's like, as a friend of mine remarked, it looks like people are actually planning to move in and are living there. But it really has just attracted immense amounts of attention and replication across the country and even elsewhere in the world. But then what do we do with that? I don't really know. I mean, I don't, you know, I think some of the people who are occupying Zuccotti Park and elsewhere around the country and the world believe that the occupation itself is the political activity. I guess I'm too old-fashioned to think that's really going to change anything. It can change conversation and can put pressure on politicians, but I don't think, you know, it is not the revolution itself. But, you know, I don't know. I think we're seeing signs of life among unions that we haven't seen in a long time. Mm-hmm. I think they're inspired to action. The New York City Central Labor Council, as I understand, is actually, which is, you know, normally a rather moribund body, has actually been talking about a march for jobs on Wall Street involving hundreds of thousands of people. So if, you know, anything like that were to materialize, that would be, you know, I think if you see unions changing, if you see politicians feeling like they have to adapt to this, you know, some of the better, there's certainly some awful Democrats, but, you know, there's some not half bad ones around too. And, you know, if they start acting less half bad, that might change things. So, but I don't really know how you go from this kind of a broad structuralist movement actually to changing things. It's not an easy thing to think about. A lot of the folks who are occupying don't like the idea of making demands. They don't like talking about, you know, articulating with the state. I mean, they think it's corrupting, that they're going to get co-opted.
Where do you stand on that? I mean, I tend to my feeling has always been that demands just give the opportunity to be dismissed. But presence and size and disruptiveness is something that needs to be addressed and let the establishment figure out how to basically appease these people.
Well, I like the idea of broad demands. I've been involved with a group of people who have been pushing for a simple demand: create 25 million public sector jobs.
And this is the demands working, you know, group, right?
It's simple. It's 25 million jobs, single payer system, environmental reconstruction, clean energy investment, that sort of thing. There are a lot of people who don't like the idea. But I also alternate between liking that and then just thinking that the occupation is a pressure tactic, and, you know, unions and policy group wonks, people like that, are the ones who have to come up with the details. So we all know what the broad demands are, even if they're not articulated. We want a more equitable distribution of income, a more humane economy, and less violence and oppression in the world. I mean, it's you know, that's what the bodies in Zuccotti Square are saying, even if their mouths are not saying it precisely in those terms.
And lastly, I was having this argument with my wife last night, and so, and I'm not going to drag you into it. It has nothing to do with what I'm doing around the house. But where do you think our power as citizens lie in withholding our labor or withholding our functioning as consumers? Because you hear proposals, everybody should not buy something for a day. And my feeling is what we need in this country are some general strikes. Because, you know, you don't buy something for a day, within a week and a half or two, you end up buying more to fill that gap. But if you hold off on your labor, you're actually really threatening the system in a greater way.
Yeah, I don't think those consumption strikes are really very effective, because, you know, people have to buy things to live. You know, it's you need to pay the electricity. What are you going to do, turn out the lights all day?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. But you're absolutely right about withholding labor. You know, despite all the globalization and offshoring, we still have something like 130 million people employed in the United States, and if you could get a large share of them to withhold their labor for a day or two, that would really attract a lot of attention. So we still have that power. Question is how to get people, the organization and the confidence to do it. But that's the way to go if we can.
All right. Well, Doug Henwood, left Business Observer and author of Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom, which is now free at wallstreetthebook.com. Did I get that right?
Yep, that's right.
We got to go. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Okay, great. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. And now we're going to head to – oh, we're out of time here. We're going to go to the better half of the program right now. On that better half of the program, we'll be taking calls, some of whom will be coming from Oakland, people who are just getting out of jail. In the better half of the program, I will be talking a little bit more about Oakland. I'll get to those News Corp stories that I promised. Also, the latest gear for your Android or perhaps iPhone if you plan to get arrested. We've gone digital, folks. And let me take this opportunity to tell you, go vote at podcastawards.com for us. You can vote for us as People's Choice or Best Politics and News. And please, folks, we're coming up on our year anniversary. I am significantly behind my projections, which, of course, I pulled out of my butt, but it's the way I sold it to my wife as to why I could do this. As to our members. So if you can afford to become a member, please do. If you can't, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll work something out. But it is, it's not much money. And frankly, I don't think you're getting this material anywhere else. Not this concisely, not this in-depth, not these guests, and not with the corporate influence. I don't care where you work. If somebody else is paying you, they have something to say about what you're doing. Not here. Well, actually, I get a lot of emails from people who comment on what I'm doing, but none of them can fire me. And so I respond politely. I either agree or I disagree. But look, here's the bottom line. Please become a member today at majority.fm. Really could use the support to keep this show going. You can also buy your crap through our Amazon link and support justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee. Use the coupon code majority, get a 10% discount. Trying to work on a website redevelopment. It's going to look sweet. All right, folks, we'll see you in the post show, in the better half of the show. You can call in at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or IM me at Majority FM, Majority FM. See you in the better half.
Don't forget to vote for us in the Podcast Awards.
All right. I still can't get an answer to my question about the what goes on in the minds of some of these sort of so-called centrist, you know, just these moneyed elite, just the Rubin types. And I think at the end of the day, they're just douchebags. You know, I mean, that could be the easiest answer. They just don't like the frickin' riffraff. Oop, sorry about that. Calling into our call service, as it were. And this one, you don't have to. Where am I? Oh, there I am. I just can't figure it out. I still can't figure out. All right, let's take a phone call. Jeff Smurf calling on Skype. You can reach us at Skype at Majority Live. Majority Live. Welcome to the program, Jeff Smurf.
Hey there, Sam. Hey, I got a question. I asked the same of Mike Malloy last night, and I couldn't get an answer. You remember that article in Salon about last December where they were talking about study in London? They found that the amygdalas in the brain –
Conservatives
was larger.
Right.
Was large. Yeah. And the amygdala is the portion of the brain that controls fear.
Right.
Okay. Question. Okay. Does an enlarged amygdala...
Jeff. Let me just say this before you go any further. I will not advocate forced lobotomies on conservatives. I want to make that absolutely clear. I will reiterate, despite the value of doing so, I do not advocate it. I will stand firmly against it.
You're no fun.
I'm sorry, buddy. I just don't think that we can do that. I just don't think it's appropriate.
Okay. Can I ask my question now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Question. Does are people more fearful because of an enlarged amygdala, or does the amygdala become enlarged because people are fearful?
Well, as you know, Jeff, I have a 4-year degree in biology, a 6-year analog degree in physiology, and I wrote my doctoral thesis in neuroscience.
Gosh, Sam.
No, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, look, I would imagine, like any muscle, if you use it enough, it gets stronger and bigger. I can tell you that. Let me knock it down a notch. I can tell you that they need constant reinforcement, which is why they listen to someone like Rush Limbaugh. They need to be constantly told they're under siege. They need to be constantly told that they are they don't have access to the media, that the gays or the Muslims, whatever the blanks are that are coming to get them, everywhere they turn, the environmentalists are seeking to attack them. Their ways of life is being threatened. You still have a cat to kick. Well, the liberals are going to come and empower the cat, and so you'll have no one to kick, and you'll just have to be kicked yourself, but you'll have no cat to kick. I know that they need that constant reinforcement. Because when you're taken out of that that zone, doubt creeps in and this and that. And so I would imagine that maybe the answer is both. But like I say, my science skills are a little bit weak right now.
Well, I figure you got some pretty smart people out there listening. So, you know, maybe one of them knows.
All right. You're right.
But also, hey, maybe we can start a study. And if there's an unemployed biochemist out there or something like that who wants to start a foundation, maybe we can get donations and do research. We'll have somebody, a normal person who's not fearful, we'll have him sit in front of a radio and listen to repeats of Rush Limbaugh for 6 hours a day and see if his amygdala gets bigger. How's that work?
I think we may run afoul of the international treaties on torture, so I wouldn't want to get engaged in that. But but maybe somebody can call in with the answer. I appreciate the call, Jeff.
Okay, cool.
Bye. What's your name?
Alyssa.
Alyssa, you're calling from Oakland. Welcome to the program, Alyssa.
Oh, thank you. Can you hear me okay? Is this phone?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, good. Yes. Yeah, I'm calling from Oakland.
And so
it was crazy there.
I understand. Were you down there in the, were you in the park Tuesday morning?
Yeah, I was in the first group that got arrested. I may have been the first person that got arrested. I'm not sure.
Oh, well, hold on for a second. That deserves a... That deserves a fanfare. Wow. All right. So, what park were you in?
I was in the Oscar, we call it the Oscar Grant Plaza. They call it the Frank Ogawa Plaza, I guess it was formerly called.
And
but yeah, we were there.
And wait, so just give me a backup for 1 second. How long were you, were you sleeping there on a regular basis? Were you just going down and visiting? Tell me what was happening in the park. Just in general.
I went back down and visited almost every day. I've been visiting and just a huge supporter of the movement. It's really been, they've done amazing things. They've created a school. I won't get into all that, but they've done really great things. So I've been going down there. I actually responded to the text they sent out because I was down there till like 11 o'clock Monday night, and then nothing was happening. So I went home, and they sent out a text at like 2:40 in the morning.
Uh-huh.
So I went back.
My understanding is they got a tip based upon some other press people saying that there was going to be a press conference, and they got a tip. But I want to even back up because I want you to tell me a little bit about what was going on at that park. You said that they were developing a school down there. You know, one of the big the excuses that the mayor of Oakland said, well, we had to close this thing down because of hygiene and safety issues. Address that.
You know, I am like was so much safer there with Occupy Oakland being in control than the mayor. It's ridiculous. I mean, the community was not exactly pretty because we took in everyone. The homeless, their needs were being addressed. Mentally ill, people were like brought into the community and you saw them kind of rejoin. It was really, you know, a great thing. And then these young people, like, they were mainly like, the people that sleep there are mainly in their 20s, but they're really dedicated, really smart, and compassionate. They just want to govern, you know, to a society that, you know, doesn't, like, judge your success by how greedy you are, but by, you know, more like being compassionate and helping each other, you know. And they were setting that up. They fed the homeless and you did all kinds of stuff. I'm going a little blank right now. Sorry.
No, but that's fine.
Yeah.
All right. So, so what happened? You came back to the park at 2:30 or so, or 3 a.m, and then what happened?
Okay. Yeah, I got the text, and you know, I'm lucky that I got in because I found out from somebody that I saw in jail later that they had blocked off the road, so they weren't even letting people in to respond to the text because I guess the police knew that they were, you know, what Oakland was doing. So I got in, and there weren't that many of us, but
when you say not that many, 50, 100, 20, 200?
I'd say more like 200, maybe more, because people were sleeping in the tent still. People were sleeping. You know, and if I forget, remind me to tell you what the police did to them. It was horrible. The police didn't come. The police, we saw helicopters and stuff, but the police didn't come. The raid didn't start till almost 5, I think. And that what they did was they, I don't know how many of them, but just probably more police than there were of us, like significantly more, came from both directions at the park, like they surrounded us. And the first thing they did was they gave us a warning. They said it was like 5 minutes, but it didn't even seem like they warned us that long. And we were singing, you know, we had talked about it. It was going to be nonviolent, you know, just, you know, and people were singing and chanting that, you know, that we were fighting for their pension. I even had I made copies of the article about Albany refusing to take the orders, that they didn't have to take, you know, unlawful orders. So, but they came up, and then the first thing they did, gave us 5 minutes, then they threw tear gas, you know, I don't know if they threw one or two of those tear gas bombs, and then they, I'm not sure if they shot those bullets, but there were like these loud bangs. So we ran over to the other side, and when we were at the other side, there was another like line of police, and they again gave us a quick warning, and before they just started coming in, everybody, we had like barricaded the area, put up a blockade, you know, to slow down the police from entering. So they came in and just were throwing stuff down. And
all right, let me stop you here for a second. Are you saying that the police, they gave you a warning, they said clear the park or you'll be arrested, and before they even attempted to arrest people, they started lobbing tear gas?
Yeah, they didn't even ask us, because, you know, to go willingly. They just threw tear gas in. Yeah. They didn't say, would you come? Nothing like that. And it didn't even seem like they gave us a full 5 minutes. You know, it just seemed like they wanted to just storm the camp, basically, like as if we were at war and they were, you know, terrorizing a village. But, you know, it was just really bad. I was surprised at the extent of brutality they showed, unnecessary. So they threw in the tear gas. We ran over to the other side and we locked arms again and were chanting peacefully. You know, and the this side of the police, you know, they started throwing the blockade stuff over, and they came in, and as they approached, I felt somebody grab me from behind. He didn't even say, would you come? He just grabbed me. A police officer grabbed me from behind. I had my bag because I have multiple sclerosis, so I had my medicine and even my ID. Everything was in my bag, but he just threw it, you know, and grabbed me forcefully. And I was like, I need my bag. You know, I have MS. My medicine's in it. He was like, too bad, you know, and I kept on saying I needed it. And it was only because of that another police officer gave it to me. He wasn't going to.
Wow.
But he handcuffed me. Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's just like, yeah. But he handcuffed me. Luckily, my handcuffs weren't that tight. You know, some people's were really extremely tight. And they left them on for like 5 hours, like almost the whole time we were in. The whole time we were in the holding cell. So he marched me down. When they came in from behind, they were also like, for the people that were still in tents, they were literally kicking them like they were playing soccer. Like just kicking the people, you know, the tents with people in them, like, you know, but two police officers. It's just terrible.
Did they approach the tents and say, you got to get out of the tents, or do they just go up and start kicking them?
They just started kicking them, knocking everything down. They destroyed everything as they came in, as they approached, you know, to the people the police that came in from behind us. They just came in destroying stuff.
So this is a
You know, and these are the same police officers. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, yeah, these are the same police officers that we were being friendly with, as friendly as possible on the marches and, you know, stuff like that. And it's just like, it was really, I don't know. I mean, I thought that I was, I understood. I thought that I knew, like, that Oakland police can be violent and don't exactly protect the people they're supposed to. But when they actually, I was still surprised. It was still shocking how far they went.
And so this is about 4:30 in the morning or so. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so what did they do with you? Once they cuffed you, once the second cop was willing to give you your bag with your MS medication, what did they do?
They took us down, and there was like a huge line of us, and processed us to put us on a bus, you know, put us on police buses. And actually, I have a little video clip I was able to take on my phone of, because the protesters were on there singing like, "We shall overcome," and these are the people they're calling violent. As the police are kicking people and sleeping bags, you know, and the actual protesters are on the bus singing. I just wanted to show that because we were peaceful, you know, and they're not the way that both the police and the media and the mayor is, portraying them.
Well, will you send us that video?
I have it online.
Send us the link to that.
It's really
video.
Not clear.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
it's
okay.
Really not clear because I was hiding the phone. Yeah.
That's all right.
So
you get into the bus, and then what happens?
They just have us sitting there forever with the cuffs on. Somebody was diabetic. They had his cuffs on too tight. It took them forever to respond to our request, you know, telling them we had an urgent medical problem. You know, it took forever for them to address that. And that's the way it was all night with different medical things that came up. So when they finally got us to the holding cell, they noticed that some of us had taken our cuffs off. And some of the officers down there weren't happy about it. So this one young girl, they just grabbed her, like twisted her wrist, like I don't know if they sprained it or what, and like put the cuffs on really tight. And they were just showing, I think they really want to crush the movement. They must feel really threatened because they were just showing, like, from the beginning, just excessive force. We were in there for I don't know how long before they moved us to another cell. And when then from that cell, they were going to process us. And when the sheriff, when one of the deputies tried to tell me something, I jumped. And because I have MS, and I tried to tell her it's not, you know, I wasn't like not cooperating anything. I just have MS. So I jump when people do it. But she wouldn't accept that. And she like tried to slammed me against the wall. And then when I said something, she said she forced me back into the cell and said that, you know, she wasn't going to process me. You know, she was going to process everybody else, but she could keep me there for like 20 hours just because I, you know, have MS and I jumped when she said something to me. Then, but the person that was in there with me then said, asked them about, she asked them, like, why were they on a power trip? And they threw her back in there with me, too, which I felt bad for her because she had to stay just because I did. And they kept us in there for a really long time, wouldn't give us our name or badge number for, you know, a long time. Luckily, I was able to get a little bit of cell service. And then, I was going to need more medicine because I thought, like, okay, if I get arrested, it'll be a couple hours. I didn't know that they were, I mean, some of the people may still be in there. I didn't know that they would, and we were charged with camping.
You were charged with camping?
Like, yeah, that's what they said at first. I was like, why are we here? He was like, oh, for camping. I was like, well, I wasn't camping. I was just here supporting them. So I guess I'm charged with this. Supporting campers, I'm not sure, but all this violence for that. What they said on the forum was they changed it to loitering and refusal to leave a riot scene. The only people rioting were the police. So then we're in the cell. They're telling me that they don't. Oh, when I said, you know, don't I have rights? You know, about, because they didn't give us a phone call. We just luckily had ourselves. They were like, welcome to jail. And I asked about getting my medicine, and, you know, I wasn't going to get any more medicine. So, so then finally they processed everybody. Me and this one woman were still in the cell. And finally I was able to get a tweet out. And thank God for Daily Kos and also the National Lawyers Guild and Twitter. I mean, I don't know what combination it was that got them to actually come in and process me or whatever, but their whole attitude changed. They were like, do you want to see a doctor, you know, et cetera. And then, but they were still being mean to everybody else. So I have mixed feelings about that, you know, but I'm glad, I'm grateful. So they finally, like, and they put us into, they finally processed us, had me see a nurse and put us in this cell with everyone and said we were going to Santa Rita. This one woman came in, she was 18, and she had come in after us. Like, there was a second round of, I guess, police, you know, people that had been blocked from the area somehow got to it, and that's when the police, like, beat up a whole second number of, you know, group of people and sent them to jail. And this 18-year-old girl, she said that she was there with her mother. First, they, like, the police attacked her mother, you know, as she was standing back, and her mother's disabled. And then when she tried to protect her mother, they grabbed her, slammed her down. That's also on video. She had, like, this big cut in her mouth, and it was just, like, terrible. And so finally I got out.
And what did they say? I heard reports that they were putting restrictions on people in terms of them returning to the park. Did they say what was going to happen to you? Did they say don't go back to the park? What did they say?
Right. They told me that if they see me in the park, they because I have a court date December 5th and a $10,000 bail, but I guess they waived that for now. They said if they see me there again, they'll hold me to December 5th, plus like double or triple the bail. That I would have to pay in order to get out before then. And I don't know if that's even like...
Who told you that? Who told you that? I want to really be explicit about this. Who told you that?
The person that was processing me when I was leaving, that was when I had to sign the papers to leave.
Uh-huh. And do you have copies of those papers? What were the papers? What did the papers say?
I have to find it. That's a good question. Because I...
And have you been in touch with the lawyer? I mean, are they providing legal? Is anybody at Occupy Oakland hooked you up with a lawyer? I'm really curious as to how people reacted to that, because I've never heard anything quite like that.
Me either. And I was... me either. The National Lawyers Guild, like I said, I think that may be why... That may be who got me out, because when they heard they weren't giving me my medicine and stuff, but I'm just not sure. But yeah, somebody from the National Lawyers Guild actually came down there to help me get me out. But I haven't talked to him. And I'm sorry, I can't find the paper that it lists like what my charges were and stuff. But yeah, he told me that, and I asked somebody else that was bailed out, and he said they told him the same thing. And I'm like I was the only person that got out, I guess, that wasn't bailed out that I know of, you know, as of like yesterday by 5 o'clock. I got out at like 12.
Wow. And so what did you do when you got out? I assume went home and rested.
Well, I was I wish. I got out. The media was there and stuff, so I talked to a couple of people. But I was supposed to get my property because they took most of it before we got on the bus. Then when I went to get it, they said that I couldn't get it until tomorrow. They weren't going to let any of us get it until tomorrow, and that I had to make an appointment. And my car keys were in it. I was like, I need my keys. And it was like they made up that law or that, you know, that yeah, that law, like, just up from as I was crossing the street. Because I had been told up until then, oh, all you have to do is go pick up your property. But when I got there, I needed an appointment, and they weren't doing it until tomorrow.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Alyssa, can I ask you, what do you do? How old are you?
I'm 43. I was working for, I was probably one of the oldest people there, too. I was working for, I did social work. I worked for Medi-Cal Outreach for a long time, and I had to stop working about 2 years ago because of the progression of MS.
Well, I got to tell you.
So I've been doing a whole bunch of volunteer.
Your story is really inspirational, and it's really.
I went back yesterday too.
You did? Tell us about that.
Yeah.
What did you see when you went back?
Oh, when I went back, we marched. Oh, it was like there were so many people because we're gonna keep meeting at in front of the library at 6 o'clock. We marched down back through the back by the plaza to the police station. I saw the police take bully their clubs and start beating up. They pulled some of us, like three people or two people, out of the group and just started like hitting them with the billy club and like slamming them down. And then the crowd was like standing around saying shame. And I just I thought there was a whole bunch. But then we divided. Then we kept marching. Then I saw like just people being tear gassed and. People told me that they were that they saw the rubber bullets and stuff. I didn't want to get arrested again, so I wasn't up front this time. Like part of me wanted to, but I was like, I'm just too tired. I need to rest. So I kind of stayed in the back, but I wanted to be there like as much as I could.
Well, Alyssa, again, it's such an inspirational story, and you know, so much bravery that you're showing, and. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. Is there anything else you wanted to let us know?
No, just that, I hope people don't let the media, like, give them, like, I hope that they understand that these are good kids. Even if you see a couple of them acting up, just think of going to a college dorm or something. You know, it's pretty age appropriate. For the most part, they are, like, way more politically informed and caring than my generation was. And what they're doing is really inspirational, you know, and I'm really grateful to them and, you know, all the other people. And there are a lot of people still in the Oakland jail, and I hope people call down there. There's a number at the Occupy Oakland website. I hope people call down there and complain about the mayor and, you know, to get people out, you know. And also, we were nonviolent.
I mean, it sounds like it. It sounds like they completely, essentially, just wanted to create a lot of violence. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. The first thing that they do is fire tear gas into a crowd without trying to just walk up and arrest people who are willing to be arrested. It sounds like to me they're looking to crack some heads.
Exactly. They want to make this point. And, yeah, they were chasing us around all night because what I hear is the city is determined not to let us form another camp. You know, and it's like, what were they doing? Helping poor people. It seems like the more a group effectively helps poor people, the harder, like, the top 1% or ruling class or whatever kind of cracks down on them. You could kind of tell how effective the movement is by how big the force is against them, maybe.
I think you're right. Well, Alyssa, I really appreciate your calling in. Don't hesitate to call in again if, you know, and give us updates on what's going on out there.
Oh, thanks a lot. And thanks for your show. I'm a huge fan. And for anybody that, like the lawyer and everybody, I do want to thank them too. So
okay.
That's all. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. Wow. That's unbelievable. Do we have that Occupy Oakland? I don't see a number on their site right now to call. Somebody will IM me the number to call into City Hall. That's stunning. The idea that they would not even take the opportunity to arrest these protesters peacefully. Certainly, the protesters sound like they were ready to be arrested in a peaceful manner. And, you know, that's the way these things go down. Certainly the way they go down in New York, right? They just wait. In Atlanta, last night, you had 53 people arrested. Park was cleared by 2 a.m. Eastern time. This is according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's obvious that people can be arrested peacefully. We've seen it all around the country. But apparently in Oakland, that's not the way it works. First, they bring the tear gas in. First, they crack some heads. And then they just pick up the pieces. Bush and Chains, one criminal banker arrested and off the street. Thousands more to go. Gupta, this is – now, you know, I was going to talk to Doug Hedwin about Gupta being arrested. Where is that? Where do I have that? Gupta was a former director, I guess, at Goldman Sachs. They have 5,000 papers all over the place here. I mean, complete mess. And – the guy's being charged with insider trading. That's all well and good. But I think the problem is it's not so much that you have insider trading. That's one of the problems. The problem is that you have fundamentally, structurally, a system that is not, that is broken. He was a former Goldman Sachs board member. He surrendered to federal authorities to face criminal charges stemming from a massive hedge fund insider trading case. You know, that it's like when people say, like, oh, people have gone to been arrested on Wall Street. Like, what about Bernie Madoff? No, that's dealing with, although it was massive in size, the run-of-the-mill fraud, not the systemic fraud that is endemic to Wall Street. The Securities and Exchange Commissioner originally brought civil fraud charges against Gupta in March. The SEC alleged that at the height of the financial crisis, he passed along privileged financial information that helped enrich Raj Rajaratnam, a former billionaire hedge fund manager, who was the prime target of a criminal probe. That's all well and good. But the entire system is a criminal enterprise. Given the criminality of an American banking corporate's crime syndicate, you're going to need a bigger boat, says Bush and Chains. Tension of Walmart drones. Durable good inventory hits all-time record. You Bush bought over-consumptionists, not doing your patriotic duty. Fed is leveraged at 53-1. Yes, 53-1 U.S. Federal Reserve with $2.8 trillion in assets and only $52 billion in capital. Attaboy, Bernanke, keep printing. Sam says deficits don't matter. I agree. I do say that, and I still agree they don't matter. Stiglitz at the UN. I have that. No wonder you're so effed up, Sam. I'm listening to this financial quack Henwood. You got to be the ultimate in embracing economic lunacy. I say debt forgiveness across the board. Nefertiti. Sammy Sugar High. Wow, I recommended Henwood yesterday and you delivered today. I love listening to Doug Henwood's analysis. That was a great interview. Thank you, Sugar High. Sam, the Blue Roots radio blog has moved and have a new name, Proligarchy, at proligarchy.com. We want more members, and we pay tribute to you each day. Check it out, folks, Proligarchy. I don't know if that name's going to work. Proligarchy.com. Can we put the link on that to the site? Don't know about bigger amygdalas, but the pathways get grooved and more default over time, just like a habit. You cannot separate nature and nurture. That's a dualist delusion. He might try the Google for the answer to that. Heathen Steven. Amygdala. I think the organ becomes comes before the emotion. Refer the government stimulus if China's currency is pegged to ours. Is there a chance they may fight back devaluing our currency by refusing to buy more of our debt? I know I keep harping on this, but I've heard too many people like Alan Grayson come on and say, neither the Keynesians nor the austerity pushers have the answer. My financial advisor says we may be entering unprecedented market conditions, but I think that's too narrow a view. It's the last 100 years of cheap economic growth. It's unprecedented. That's what's coming to an end. What does your financial advisor advise? I think we are entering unprecedented market conditions, but I don't know what that means. Well, the problem with just stimulating the economy, it just depends on how you go about doing it. And I say have the Fed print up money and give it to people, or essentially buy up everybody's mortgage. Or I'm being a little, there's a little hyperbole there, but not much. Debt jubilee, folks. That's what I say. Banks are going down anyways. Dradmanthes. Hi, Sam. I was looking at comments on a San Jose Mercury News article on Occupy Oakland. The anti-protester comments seemed to all focus on how dirty the protesters were and how great it was the cops had cleaned up the plaza at City Hall. The protests were labeled as smelly, filth, and rats. Combined with the fact that Bloomberg wanted to clean up Zuccotti Park to remove protesters, I'm wondering if there's a common tactic that all the Occupy movement will face. There are two tactics on a practical level that you'll hear. One is it's really dirty down there. When, in fact, at least my understanding of this park prior before to the Occupy movement was that it was dirty already. There were rats there at night. And they're actually being kept away by the presence of people. The other one is you'll hear is that it's costing the city too much. Cops, robbers are going to be, exploiting. The cops aren't there. There's no empirical data to show that. And to the extent that it's costing too much, sounds to me like the cops have all this equipment they want to use, at least in Oakland. Down in New York, I don't know what it's like today, but when we were down there last week, the cop presence was minimal. Matt, wasn't it like incredibly reduced, the amount of cops that were there?
Yeah, there were a lot less.
Because the city's just gotten wise. They just like, no, like, all right.
There used to be almost every time every time until the last time we walked there, we always passed by like a whole like crowd of cops hanging out
50,
across
60,
the street.
Yeah, cops like just hanging out
in a group. Yeah, they were not there the last time.
Yep, they would just hang out like it was lunchtime on a film set. That was the one thing when we were doing beat cops. We had a couple of cops who were advisors, and then you have to have, because Benjamin and I were dressed as cops, you need to be, we needed, even though we didn't have a closed off set, even though we weren't closing off, we needed two cops to escort us at all times. Because people would literally walk up to Benjamin and I and ask for directions, and I was like waving people off to see if there was a bicycle on the sidewalk. I'd be like, yo, move it. It really was one of the funnest weeks of my life to be able to dress in a cop suit. And then at lunch, we'd have two guys working with us all day. And then at lunch, there was like six to eight cops. They'll just show up for free lunch. And, of course, we're like, you know, definitely have lunch. Makes it seem really important they have sanitation committees who are broadcasting what they're doing to the media constantly. The most disturbing thing to me about the comments that I read is they sound a lot like eliminationist rhetoric with references to vermin and filth. Yeah, of course. Rioting campers, that's bullshit. Well, that's a good idea. Ian Long's a quiet night at Baltimore last night. This is our guy Ian, who has been at Occupy Baltimore since the beginning. But the city mandate was unclear whether we were in violation last night or tonight. Baltimore Police Department hasn't confirmed they will remove us, but the city is supposed to send a representative to our GA to discuss terms tonight. I'm not sure what that means for us, but tonight is ominous. Please send me emails and updates, Ian. And we'll have tons of cameras on site. We're working on a contingency, but there is no clear consensus on how to handle things if we're dispersed. I think the city doesn't want to deal with the press of clearing us. They may just go after our tents. Either way, I'll call in tomorrow if I'm not in jail. Oh, and it's my birthday today. Oh, happy birthday. Let me see if I can do even a little better than that. For your birthday, spending it down at Occupy Baltimore. Very impressive. No, sorry. The best I can do is this. Can I have my computer?
Short and his tail cut long. Oh, where can he be?
There you go. You got to get that soundboard on your computer, dude. It's awesome. Okajik, I just have to say super show today, Sam. Thank you. Thank you, Okajik. I know all of you going to podcastaward.com and voting for People's Choice you can vote for us for People's Choice and News and Political. Don't forget to confirm the email that comes afterwards. You can vote every day. That phone call single-handedly justified calling this the better half of the program. You know, this is the dilemma I have with that now, is that I want to get that whole interview out there. I mean, this is why, I would rather have no member part of the program or, you know, and just have the whole show available to everybody. But, you know, from a business standpoint, that's not very effective. But I feel like, you know, when we have an interview like that, I'm doing an injustice to the world. I don't want to get a little grandiose here, but I'm doing an injustice at least to those people in Oakland and to Alyssa to not make that more widely available. I may do that. You know, it's not like an interview with Marin or with Cross that, you know, I can leverage. I'm going to use to leverage. I think we're going to have to put it out for everybody. So maybe we'll record a liner. And I'll tack it on to the full show. I don't know. Clower, Texas Rangers. Since losing George W. Bush, have gone from bankruptcy to World Series. Is there hope for us? Well done. Kevin, 11721. If the middle class knew the owner's class wasn't going to share in the benefits of computerization and automation with them, they would have never have invented them. Where did you? Oh, yeah. You said that to me the other day. Well, you know, like I said, that I was mentioning yesterday, that futurist who was like, with all the automation and these things called computers that are coming, we're going to have to learn how to spend our leisure time more wisely. And all I know is that ever since I got a computer, I have no leisure time. That's like, you sent me this sound thing at 12 o'clock last night. That's all I do is I go home. It's all I do. That's my entire day. I go home, have dinner, which is always nice most of the time, put Milo to bed, do her homework, and I come back out, and I just start pulling stories. I'm doing the same thing I do here, except for I'm just not talking. And if I start to talk, then Nikki tells me to stop, just be quiet. That's basically my average day. And then once a week, I go out. Like now, I'm excited to run errands. Just because I get to do something different. Is that working for you or no? I'll just take. Let me take this one. Is this Tim Johnson? Who's on Skype?
Yeah, I'm Tim here. I'm here in Phnom Penh. I escaped Bangkok. I was at the university, Assumption University, and one of our professors looked at a topographical map of Bangkok, and it turns out we were at the lowest point in Bangkok. I have photos from the flight out. I can't tell you what it looks like. It's a sea of water coming down on this huge city, and they are lying to everybody. They are not telling them what's really happening. 2 weeks ago, they said Bangkok will never flood. 7-Eleven is a motherfucker, okay? They are not supplying their stores with water. They're just abandoning shit, basically. It's all a money thing. I can't believe, 7-Elevens are everywhere in Bangkok, and they suck, okay? But people are going to die. I have puppies out in my soy that my bitch just had, and they're going to die because I'm so mad at the Thai government. I'm telling you, Sam, I don't think any government in the world could ever be good. I know that the means government doesn't suck, but I'm just saying that in every case, they lie to the people, they kill the people, they don't care about the people. Always the rich win and the poor lose.
Wow. So wait, Tim, just recount what's happened over the play. We spoke to you on Monday. You were in your apartment building with 20 liters of water. What happened? You said you were going to ride it out. So tell me what happened.
The university declared yesterday, because of secret information that they know, that basically the place where we're at is going to flood at least a meter, at least a half, 1.5 meters, maybe two. 2 meters, that's 6 feet. That's going to cover the door on the bottom floor of our building. We can't even get in. We have to swim underneath. All the 7-Elevens have purpose. I mean, so anyway, this university declared 3 weeks that of the canceled classes. They said everyone just said get out. And everyone is getting out. I went to the airport. It's a madhouse. There was no domestic flights available on AirAsia. International flights are easier to get because you needed a passport. A lot of Thais don't have passports. Here in Phnom Penh, I'm dry. I escaped. I can't believe I got out. I had to borrow money, and it sucks. It's just, I mean, I'm happy here now. I'm happy to be alive.
And so what's happening to the people in Bangkok? I mean, where do they go?
Nowhere. That's the point. There's 12 million 14 million, depends on how you count. There's so many illegals there. How can I say this? My friend just went around to, like, people he knows that are poor and just gave them money. People are hanging. The one family I know, they lost their compound, $100,000 house. Now they're in the $20,000 house that they're the kids live in, the old people, and that's going to go. And now there's no place to go in Bangkok. I mean, people are running out of places to go. The poll, I have these photos on Facebook that I can send you that show a sea north of Bangkok, and it's all coming down because of the way the topography goes. It goes down. Bangkok's at the end of the line, basically, of all the water.
So where, I mean, literally, I mean, can people get out of Bangkok? Can they go? Is there any high ground outside of Bangkok?
There is no overland routes. There's a lot of high buildings in Bangkok. So I'm just assuming that people will just go up. People that live in 2-3-story houses are going up to their second floor, third floor. The first floor is going to be completely ruined. Things are made with low fire bricks. When they get sucked with water, they just explode and are ruined. Although there are cement pylons, the basic frame, but usually what happens is all the buildings are destroyed. This is an immense tragedy, and it's just happening, and it's going to happen over the next 2 days. Governor of Bangkok said that all 50 districts, every district in Bangkok is going to be flooded.
Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. My friends got out tomorrow. They got a flight to Vietnam. Everyone's going to have to get new jobs. My friend Poon, he was laid off from the Toyota factory. He's fishing. They catch. I'm just saying they're making the best of it they can. But you know, they're used to water. But it's beyond anything human imagination. I would say this is a human catastrophe. What they did was they held back water because they usually do for the rice fields during the rainy season. But there was so much water that all the dams. And they showed the capacity. Some are like 7 billion cubic meters is a big one. And then the total amount is about 20 billion cubic meters of water. And they were like 130% capacity. So they had to release all this water because the rains came late and they stayed late.
So in other words, typically during the rainy season, they will fill up essentially the reservoirs and use this for the rice fields. But this year, because of the intensity and the length of the rain, they got caught essentially with their pants down. Right? I mean, is that basically it? They had to release more than they thought they were going to, and it's flooding.
They had to release it up in the north, and it's just been coming down, and everyone's been saying, oh, my gosh, this is coming, it's coming, it's coming. And, you know, there was a false alarm 2 weeks ago. I evacuated then, and I had to come back because I ran out of money, and I got robbed here in Phnom Penh. This time I'm in a better place. It's only $3 a day. It's great. I got Wi-Fi. It sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And everything's fine.
All right. Well, Tim, thanks for giving us an update. Just a horrible, horrible tragedy that so many people, I just don't understand. I mean, I just don't understand what's going to happen. I mean, it's just so hard to wrap your head around it.
Well, it's great to hear your voice, Sam, and I really love listening to your program. My heart goes out to Oakland and those people in jail. I lived in Oakland many years. I don't know what happened, why the governor isn't helping. And, you know, I thought he was a liberal.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, Tim, thanks for calling in and giving us updates. Stay safe and, you know, check in with us. Let us know what you hear.
All right, great.
Bye. Wow. We have two, Kevin 11721. We have two competing success paradigms, the virtue paradigm, where success is a result of virtues, and the wish we can create a system where success was the result of virtues, like hard work, creativity, as opposed to luck. And the futurist you speak of was GE's progress land in the 63 World's Fair. I don't know if that's the case. Maybe. Long Doggy. Hi, Sam. I love the caller, Alyssa. I want to give her a big hug. I wonder if you could separate that audio and release. It's a great chronicle of what went down. Everyone should know about it. Yeah. We will do that. It will make it an embeddable clip, and we will put it on the front page of the blog and encourage people to embed it places. Maybe we'll make it a YouTube as well. Also, I found out yesterday the judge in my foreclosure case declined to authorize a sale and dismissed the case. So they can't sell my house. Oh, excellent. That chain of title is a real bitch. I'd like to try and help others stuck in the dual-track foreclosure modification nightmare. I think I'll email the judgment to Majority Report when I get it. Maybe you can talk about it sometime. I would love to. That would be great. That's excellent. What state are you in? Different states tend to be a little bit, you know, have a certain little more of a leeway. In Massachusetts now, all you got to say is like chain of title. And my sense is that somebody better show up there with a legitimate chain of title. You're in Colorado. Okay, that's good to know. Herbalaz, if the already enlarged amygdala causes conservatives to be fearful, then can we say right-wingers suffer from a brain affliction? Is this genetic? In cases we may be in that case, we may be doomed as a species. Yeah. Sam, that was a perfect interview for your YouTube channel. Which one are you referring to? Actually, I put up the Tim Johnson one, too. Because there's just not much information about Thailand. Nikki's got a friend over there, too, in Bangkok. She's like, I didn't hear anything about this. I'm like, well, maybe you should listen to my radio show. I mean, that. 767654. I have MS too. That a cop would deny someone their MS meds is a fucking crime. I'm 42 and down to working from home 3 days a week, and it actually gives me courage to hear other people with the same disability who can't work anymore and are still out there being productive. Thanks for putting her on the air. You're well worth a few bucks that I toss your way. By the way, did you see Hot Coffee on Colbert last night? Oh, darn it. I missed it. She told me she was going on. Put the phone call on YouTube with a link on Twitter and Facebook. Will do. Into architecture. Sugar High 777. Hey, Sammy, I signed up a few weeks ago and never chose reward swag. We got a Bad Situationist DVD, a Pilot Season DVD, Who's the Caboose DVD, and we may have a couple RNC DVDs as well. Email us. We'll hook you up. I'm a member, and I think you should make this entire podcast free to everyone. This shit is just too important not to disseminate wildly. Okajik, make the interview public and say, here's what you get when you're a member. Clower, oh, no, being conservative is a lifestyle choice, not a genetic condition. Long Doggy, they changed the law here to legalize MERS. Oh, they did? I used a different argument people should know about in places that don't care about chain of title. Oh, excellent. All right, definitely send me that. Kevin 11721, Walt Disney created the exhibit for GE. I'll check that out. And the final I am of the day, ladies and gentlemen. Left Coast Marcus, if there was a missing blonde girl in flooded Thailand, it would be all over the news. Hey, is there new member swag, WTF? No, it's the same member swag. Send me an email, Left Coast Marcus, if you never got yours, at majorityreporters@gmail.com. You have to request it. All right, folks. We will see you tomorrow. Who's on the show tomorrow? I don't know. You're going to have to wait and see. That's the way we roll here. Every day is a new wonderful surprise. Isn't that right? That's certainly how sure everybody who works here feels.
I walk in the morning and I ask Sam, who do we have on today?
No, that's not what you say. Matt comes in every day and he's like, Sam, what's the new wonderful surprise you have for us? And I say, today, Matt, the wonderful surprise is... And listen, I got to drag that harp in every day.
Just for when I ask him to.
Don't forget the podcast awards, podcastawards.com. People's Choice.
One more day for that. One more day.
Only one more day. Yeah, I fricked up on the email. Milo heard me say fucked up last night. So this morning she heard me say it. She was pissed. She's like, go to your room. And we're like, we got to go. We got to leave for school. She's like, Mom, tell him he's got to go to his room. So we have to make a show of me getting punished tonight. It was inappropriate use of those words. All right, folks, see you tomorrow.
While I shifted